This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to liposarcoma and amputations, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with liposarcoma. And the first question reads, a 50-year-old man undergoes marginal excision of a tumor in his thigh. A preoperative axial T1-weighted MRI shows areas of fat that are not isointense with subcutaneous fat. Histological analysis show mature liposites with variation in size and shape, scattered atypical cells with pleomorphism and hyperchromatic nuclei. Fibrous tissue septa are present that contain spindle cells or highly pleomorphic cells. Immunohistochemistry reveals stain positivity for MDM2 and CDK4. What is the most likely diagnosis? And the choices are 1. Rhabdomyosarcoma, 2. Lipoma, 3. Atypical lipomatous tumor, 4. Leiomyosarcoma, and 5. Myxofibrosarcoma. So this patient has an atypical lipomatous tumor, also known as a well-differentiated liposarcoma, if found in a retroperitoneal location. MDM2 and CDK4 oncogene amplification differentiates it from other sarcomas. Benign lipomas do not stain for MDM2 and CDK4. Atypical lipomatous tumors are a low-grade malignancy of relatively mature adipocytes that exhibit focal atypia. It is a common liposarcoma subtype, making up 40 to 45% of liposarcomas, and peaks at age 40 to 60 years old. It's found in the lower limbs, retroperitoneum, trunk, as well as the head and neck region. Treatment is with marginal excision. It does not metastasize unless it dedifferentiates. Subcutaneous or intramuscular tumors may recur, but typically do not dedifferentiate or metastasize. Retroperitoneal tumors are difficult to resect with clear margins and have a poor prognosis. Ring chromosomes derived from 12q13 to 15 are found in almost all cases. The sensitivity/specificity of CDK4 for detecting atypical lipomatous tumors were 86% and 89%. Those of MDM2 were 86% and 74%. Wang et al. Looked at MDM2/CDK4 gene amplification in 140 large/deep-seated tumors thought to be lipomas. They found that the incidence of MDM2/CDK4 amplification in this setting is low, roughly 5%, with a 95% confidence interval between 1.4 and 8.6. Variables associated with amplification were location, such as in the thigh, size of greater than 10 centimeters, and presence of equivocal atypia. Gene amplification did not affect recurrence rates. They recommend assessing for MDM2/CDK4 amplification in lipomas which are greater than 100 millimeters in size, show equivocal atypia, and arise in the thigh, although the significance of this gene amplification in this setting is unclear. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1 is incorrect as rhabdomyosarcomas occur mostly in children and have the histologic appearance of a quote small round blue cell tumor. They stain for muscle-specific proteins like myogenin, which is highly specific, muscle-specific actin, desmin, D-myosin, and myod1. Expression of PAX3 FKHR fusion genes occur in alveolar types of rhabdomyosarcomas. They do not stain for MDM2 and CDK4. Answer 2 is incorrect as lipomas do not stain for MDM2 and CDK4. Answer 4 is incorrect as leiomyosarcomas are rare soft tissue neoplasms and a primary leiomyosarcoma of the extremities is likely to have arisen from the wall of a blood vessel. They do not stain for MDM2 and CDK4. Answer 5 is incorrect as myxofibrosarcoma is a common soft tissue sarcoma of elderly patients. It stains for pankeratin, S100 protein, desmin, and alpha smooth muscle actin. They do not stain for MDM2 and CDK4. And moving on to the final question for this topic, a 47-year-old woman with no past medical history undergoes a workup for a 5-centimeter thigh mass deep to the fascia. Needle biopsy resulted in undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma. What is the most important factor in preventing recurrent local disease after resection? And the choices are 1. Use of preoperative chemotherapy with wide resection, 2. Use of preoperative and postoperative chemotherapy with wide resection, 3. Radiation alone, 4. Adequacy of surgical margin, and 5. Use of chemotherapy only. So the risk of local recurrence in soft tissue sarcoma is most directly related to the adequacy of surgical margin, making 4. Adequacy of surgical margin the correct answer to this question. While radiation can be used to supplement surgery, it cannot take the place of adequate surgical margins. Noria et al. Retrospectively reviewed 65 patients referred to their oncologic center for sarcomas with residual disease following resection. The authors did not find any correlation between the amount of residual disease and initial size, grade, or treatment regimen. They recommended that the most important factor to prevent recurrence was wide resection with clean margins. Venkatesan et al. Reviewed 42 patients that presented with residual disease following unplanned excision of high-grade sarcomas without planned biopsy. These patients had devastating results, leading the authors to definitively conclude, quote, excision of deep or large soft tissue masses without tissue diagnosis is unacceptable. And moving on to the next topic of amputations, the first question reads, which one of the following lower extremity amputations requires a soft tissue balancing procedure to prevent deformity following amputation? And the choices are 1. Gritty Stokes, 2. Transtibial, 3. Transmetatarsal, 4. Knee disarticulation, and 5. Lisfranc. So the Lisfranc level amputation removes the attachment of the peroneus brevis, that is on the base of the fifth metatarsal, and the peroneus longus, which is on the base of the first metatarsal, creating a varus deformity due to unopposed overpull by the tibialis anterior and posterior muscles. The anterior tibialis tendon transfer may be necessary. Other possible tissue balancing choices include posterior tibialis transfer and lengthening of the gastroxoleus complex. Another option is to leave the base of the fifth metatarsal attached to preserve the eversion pull of the peroneus brevis. All the other amputations do not require soft tissue balancing procedures to prevent deformities. However, adherence to the prescribed surgical techniques for reattachment of major muscle groups is important for optimizing limb strength and function. Moving on to the next question. Targeted muscle reinnervation has demonstrated success in treatment of which of the following? And the choices are 1. Traumatic brachial plexus neuropraxia, 2. Post-amputation neuroma pain, 3. Parsonage-Turner syndrome, 4. Complete spinal cord injury, and 5. Carpal tunnel syndrome. So targeted muscle reinnervation has demonstrated efficacy in treatment of post-amputation neuroma pain and improvement in the use of myoelectric prosthetics. After traumatic amputation, the proximal ends of severed nerves may form painful neuromas which can interfere with consistent prosthetic wear. Surgical management of neuroma pain by resection has unpredictable success. Targeted muscle reinnervation is a way to guide axon formation in amputated nerves. By reconstituting peripheral nerve anatomy to new distal targets, there may be a way to treat or prevent painful neuromas. Fitzgibbons et al. Reviewed the outcomes of transhumeral amputation. These patients tend to have difficulty using prostheses and frequently have phantom limb pain. They described targeted muscle reinnervation for transhumeral amputation as a new technique for providing improved control of upper extremity prostheses. Targeted muscle reinnervation involves nerve transfer of those nerves that have lost their distal connection with muscle. Transfer is performed to redundant proximal muscles, which provides new inputs for myoelectric prosthetic control. Recent research has suggested it is a useful treatment for post-amputation neuroma pain. Gart et al. Present the surgical technique for targeted muscle reinnervation. The procedure is done under general anesthesia without long-acting paralytics, as nerve stimulation is necessary. The amputated ends of the motor nerves are identified, mobilized, and implanted into new entry points. These new coaptations are secured with suture or fibrin glue. Moving on to the next question. A 76-year-old patient underwent partial foot amputation through the talonavicular and calcaneocuboid joints. Besides Achilles tendon lengthening, what additional procedures may be required to prevent the most common postoperative deformity? And the choices are 1. Posterior capsular release, 2. Anterior tibialis transfer to the talar neck, 3. Anterior tibialis transfer to the cuboid, 4. Flexor hallucis longus transfer to the calcaneus, and 5. Peroneus brevis transfer to the calcaneus. So Achilles tendon lengthening and anterior tibialis transfer to the talar neck would be required to prevent equinovirus deformity. Partial foot amputation through the talonavicular and calcaneocuboid joints is also known as the Chopard amputation. Chopard amputation alone is known to result in significant equinovirus deformity. This deformity results in excessive pressure on the anterior wound during gait, causing pain and wound complications. Transfer of the tibialis anterior tendon to the talar neck will provide force and muscle tone that promotes ankle dorsiflexion. Lengthening of the Achilles tendon will also reduce the equinus moment force across the ankle joint. Dillon et al. Examined the gait patterns of partial foot amputees. They found that amputations proximal to the metatarsal heads compromised the normal propulsive function of the foot and ankle. The ideal level of amputation to maintain normal propulsive function was distal to the metatarsal heads, for example, disarticulating the metatarsal phalangeal joint. Moving on to the next question. A 34-year-old female is involved in a high-speed motor vehicle collision and sustains a traumatic proximal forearm amputation. She successfully undergoes debridement and closure, and 6 weeks later is fitted with her temporary prosthesis. In order to optimize her outcomes upon returning to work as a secretary, which of the following is recommended? And the choices are 1. Obtaining formal functional capacity testing. 2. Waiting for final prosthesis fitting prior to full release. 3. Minimize use of her prosthetic while at work. 4. Allowing return to work when full elbow range of motion is seen. And 5. Offer outpatient psychological counseling. So upper extremity trauma has serious acute psychological effects that can linger long after the physical injury. These effects may negatively affect patient-reported outcomes and may also be associated with worsening pain complaints. Coping and stress management techniques can be reviewed with formal psychological counseling and should be offered to all patients who have underwent an amputation. Richards et al. Surveyed 34 patients who had emergency upper extremity surgery and found high levels of psychological distress in patients, including 29% with high levels of both depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. They also found that disability was strongly related to pain, depression, and PTSD symptoms. Mallette et al. Assessed the attitudes of hand surgery patients and hand surgeons regarding psychological influences on illness and compared their attitudes with those of the general population. They found that surgeons underestimated the openness of patients to discuss psychological issues and that patients believed in the strong effect of psychologic factors on healing and pain. Moving on to the next question. A 27-year-old combat veteran undergoes a late limb amputation following a blast injury. Discussing the risks and complications of the procedure, the treating surgeon discusses the risk of non-union and bone bridge dislocation. What type of amputation is the surgeon referring to? And the choices are 1. Fibula protibia, 2. Modified Ertl amputation, 3. Modified Burgess amputation, 4. Skew flap transtibial amputation, and 5. Long posterior flap transtibial amputation. So these complications are unique to the modified Ertl transtibial amputation, making 2 the correct answer to this question. The Ertl operation was intended to enhance prosthetic end bearing. The original Ertl amputation required a cortical periosteal flap bridge, while the modified Ertl uses a fibular strut graft. This procedure requires longer operative and tourniquet times than the standard Burgess transtibial amputation. The fibula is fixed in place with cortical screws, fiber wire suture, with end buttons, or heavy non-absorbable sutures. Tintel et al. Compared the complications of 100 modified Burgess and 37 modified Ertl amputations. There were more complications in the Ertl group, and the non-infectious complication rate was not lower. These include bone bridge complications in 32% of patients, delayed union/non-union in 11% of patients, and implant-related complications in 27% of patients. They advise careful patient selection when choosing to perform the modified Ertl amputation. Keeling compared the functional outcomes following 38 modified Burgess and 27 modified Ertl amputations. They found no differences between treatment cohorts with regard to functional and health-related quality of life variables. They do not recommend routinely performing the Ertl amputation. Taylor et al. Retrospectively reviewed 26 patients with Ertl and 10 with traditional transtibial amputation. The Ertl group had greater rates of return to work, decreased rates of revision, and improved sickness impact profile questionnaire results. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following patients is more likely to have an overall poorer outcome following a lower extremity amputation? And the choices are 1. A male patient with a below knee amputation, 2. A male patient with a through the knee amputation performed in a zone of injury, 3. A male patient treated with a myoplasty at the time of wound closure, 4. A female patient with an above knee amputation, and 5. A female patient using a less technologically sophisticated prosthesis. So many factors influence the outcome of lower extremity amputations, with worse outcomes noted in patients with lower socioeconomic status, pre-existing medical conditions, and low self-efficacy. Patients with amputations performed in a zone of injury, especially if this was a through-the-knee amputation, have a significantly poorer outcome than those with either above-the-knee or below-the-knee amputations. So the correct answer to this question is 2. A male patient with a through-the-knee amputation performed in a zone of injury has an overall poorer outcome. Patients with above-the-knee amputations have similar outcomes to those with below-the-knee amputations, although those with below-the-knee amputations have faster self-selected walking speeds. Gender and sophistication of the prosthesis have no bearing on outcome. The type of muscle anchoring technique used also plays no role in outcome. Moving on to the next question. A rocker-soled shoe, toe filler, and extended carbon fiber foot plate are appropriate post-amputation devices for which of the following foot amputations? And the choices are 1. Transmetatarsal, 2. Lisfranc, 3. Boyd, 4. Perigoff, and 5. Syme. So a transmetatarsal amputation has enough length and necessary muscle attachments to be functional in a shoe. So the correct answer to this question is 1. Transmetatarsal. All the other amputations are more proximal and require a prosthetic device that incorporates the foot and controls the ankle. Studies have shown that a full-length shoe with a total contact insert and a rigid rocker bottom sole was the most effective footwear combination in reducing peak plantar pressure on the distal residuum of patients with diabetes and a transmetatarsal amputation. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following is considered a disadvantage of knee disarticulation when compared with transfemoral amputation? And the choices are 1. Increased energy expenditure, 2. Worse end-bearing surface, 3. Asymmetry of the prosthetic knee joint, 4. More pain with weight bearing, and 5. More stump complications in pediatric patients. So the decision to perform a transfemoral amputation versus a knee disarticulation remains controversial because there are advantages and disadvantages to each procedure. One potential advantage of the knee disarticulation is that the energy expenditure during walking may be less than that for a transfemoral amputee. Another advantage is that the knee disarticulation provides for an end-bearing residual limb. The knee disarticulation also includes complete preservation of the thigh muscles, leading to better muscular balance, and the bulbous shape of the residual limb leads to increased stability of the prosthesis. Disadvantages of knee disarticulation include limitations in knee joint prosthetic components and concerns regarding the cosmesis of the prosthesis, as well as the asymmetry of the knee joints with respect to sitting and gait. Because knee disarticulations are relatively uncommon compared to transfemoral amputations, many prosthetists may have less familiarity with the fabrication and fit of this prosthesis. One of the more important issues with respect to knee disarticulation versus transfemoral amputation is the degree of trauma involving the soft tissue around the knee, as increased tissue trauma may lead to painful residual limbs and eventually the need for revision amputation at a higher level. If the residual limb of the knee disarticulation is unable to accommodate the distal end weight bearing of the socket, then patients with a knee disarticulation may experience decreased levels of function compared with patients undergoing transfemoral amputation. But the correct answer to this question is 3. Asymmetry of the prosthetic knee joint is considered a disadvantage of knee disarticulation when compared with transfemoral amputation. Moving on to the next question. Glenohumeral disarticulation often leads to which of the following changes? And the choices are 1. Hiking of the shoulder girdle, 2. Hypertrophy of the amputated shoulder girdle, 3. Improvement in thoracic spinal deformity, 4. Protraction of the shoulder, and 5. Winging of the scapula. So postural abnormalities are common after high upper extremity amputation. Normally, the weight of the upper extremity and the shoulder girdle muscles keep the shoulder balanced. When the arm is amputated and the scapula remains, the shoulder girdle muscles are unopposed, resulting in upward movement, often called hiking of the shoulder girdle. In a growing child, removal of the entire upper limb can result in scoliosis of the spine due to muscle imbalance. Abnormal shoulder elevation can often be minimized by corrective exercises and wearing a shoulder prosthesis. Moving on to the next question. Compared with myodesis, osteomyoplasty offers which of the following advantages in transtibial amputation? And the choices are 1. Enhanced end bearing, 2. Early prosthetic fitting, 3. Immediate weight bearing, 4. Fibular abduction, and 5. Decreased surgical morbidity. So osteomyoplasty in transtibial amputation, originally described by Ertl in 1949, features creation of a bone bridge between the distal tibia and fibula, which is theorized to enhance bony stability and increase end bearing of the residual limb, and may enhance patient-perceived functional outcomes relative to myodesis. Fibular abduction is a known complication of traditional myodesis techniques and is believed to represent syndesmotic instability. Osteomyoplasty requires additional surgical time and increased surgical morbidity, and because the success of the procedure is dependent on achieving bony union, early prosthetic fitting and immediate weight bearing are typically contraindicated. So the correct answer to this question is 1, enhanced end bearing. Moving on to the next question. Mirror therapy is indicated for which of the following clinical conditions? And the choices are 1, impaired proprioception after lower extremity injury, 2, two-stage flexor tendon reconstruction, 3, plumism, 4, anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, and 5, phantom pain. So mirror therapy is a useful technique to improve phantom pain in amputees. Phantom limb pain is a painful sensation that is perceived within a body part that no longer exists. Under mirror therapy, a patient is allowed to feel the imaginary movement of the removed body part behaving as a normal body movement through a mirror. The mirror image of the normal body part helps reorganize and integrate the mismatch between proprioception and visual feedback of the amputated segment. Tillock et al. Performed a randomized controlled trial of 26 patients with phantom limb pain and found that mirror therapy as well as transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation both significantly improved pain scores, but no difference was seen between the two groups. They recommend use of both modalities in treatment of phantom limb pain as they are non-invasive and inexpensive. Chan et al. Reviewed 22 patients utilizing mirror therapy for amputation-related phantom limb pain and found that patients reported a significant decrease in pain when utilizing this treatment modality as compared to covered mirror therapy or mental imagery therapy. Moving on to the next question. A 70-year-old female with a history of poorly controlled diabetes mellitus presents with purulent ulcers along the plantar aspect of her right forefoot and exposed metatarsal bone. She elects to undergo an amputation. She is insensate to the midfoot bilaterally. Her ankle brachial index, or ABI, for her right posterior tibial artery is 0.4. Further preoperative evaluation demonstrates a transcutaneous oxygen pressure of 45 and an albumin of 3.4. Which of the following would be a contraindication to performing a SIME amputation, otherwise known as an ankle disarticulation, in this patient? And the choices are 1, albumin of 3.4, 2, active osteomyelitis, 3, ABI of 0.4 for the posterior tibial artery, 4, transcutaneous oxygen pressure of 45, and 5, peripheral neuropathy. So a SIME amputation, also known as an ankle disarticulation, is a function-preserving amputation option that allows for terminal weight-bearing. However, strict criteria must be met for a patient to undergo a successful SIME amputation. An ABI less than 0.5 for the posterior tibial artery in a patient with diabetes would be a contraindication for this procedure, as success is dependent on the vascular supply of the posterior tibial artery to the plantar flap and heel pad. So the correct answer to this question is 3, an ABI of 0.4 for the posterior tibial artery would be a contraindication to performing a SIME amputation. Pinzer et al. Retrospectively reviewed their results when performing a single-stage SIME ankle disarticulation in patients with diabetes either for peripheral neuropathy or infection. Patient with ABIs less than 0.5 for the posterior tibial artery had significantly decreased healing rates, and smokers had a threefold increased risk of postoperative infection. Moving on to the next question. In addition to lengthening the Achilles, transfer of which tendon is most important for functional ambulation after performing a Chopard amputation of the foot? And the choices are 1, peroneus brevis, 2, peroneus longus, 3, tibialis anterior, 4, tibialis posterior, and 5, flexor hallucis longus. So the partial foot amputation through the talonavicular and calcaneocuboid joints is also known as the Chopard amputation. The Chopard amputation may result in significant equinovarus deformity with anterior weight bearing through the scar line, predisposing to skin breakdown over time. Therefore, lengthening of the Achilles tendon and transfer of the tibialis anterior to the talar neck should also be performed in conjunction with this disarticulation. The tibialis anterior transfer results in dorsiflexion and distributes the weight-bearing portion more centrally, and the lengthening of the Achilles tendon is necessary to accommodate this posteriorly. Transfer of the tibialis anterior or posterior tibialis to the calcaneus would exacerbate the equinovarus deformity. Shortening of the Achilles tendon would also exacerbate the anterior loading of the scar. But the correct answer to this question is 3, tibialis anterior. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following amputations will lead to the greatest oxygen requirement per meter walked following prosthesis fitting? And the choices are 1, an above knee amputation or a transfemoral, 2, below knee amputation or transtibial, 3, a through knee amputation, 4, a cyme amputation, and 5, a midfoot amputation. So the general trend is increasing energy requirement for more proximal amputations. Amputation should be performed at the lowest possible level in order to preserve the most function. Pinzer compared 5 patients with amputations at the midfoot, cymes, BKA, through knee, and AKA with 5 controls. Walking speed and cadence decreased while oxygen consumption per meter walked increased with each more proximal amputation. The only exception is the cyme, which was the most energy efficient even though it was more proximal to the midfoot amputation. But the correct answer to this question is 1, above knee amputation or transfemoral will lead to the greatest oxygen requirement per meter walked following prosthesis fitting. Moving on to the next question. A 33-year-old man requires a transfemoral amputation because of a mangling injury to his leg. 6 months after the amputation, he has persistent difficulty with ambulation because his distal femur moves into a subcutaneous position in his lateral thigh. It persists despite a well-fitted prosthesis. What technical error is the most likely cause of his dysfunction? And the choices are 1, inadequate posterior skin flap, 2, inadequate anterior skin flap, 3, failure to bevel the distal femur, 4, lack of abductor myodesis to the femur, and 5, lack of adductor myodesis to the femur. So adductor myodesis is a critical part of a transfemoral amputation. If it is not performed, then the adductors and hip flexors can cause the femur to abduct, leading to severe problems with gait. The gait disturbance persists despite proper prosthetic fitting. A transfemoral amputation is usually performed with equal anterior and posterior flaps. So the correct answer to this question is 5, lack of adductor myodesis to the femur. Pinzer et al. Highlight the fact that amputations are reconstructive procedures and should leave the patient with a functional residual limb. Moving on to the next question. During a Lisfranc or tarsometatarsal amputation of the foot, which of the following is crucial to prevent the patient from having a supinated foot during gait? And the choices are 1, releasing the posterior tibialis tendon, 2, preserving the soft tissue envelope, that is the peroneus brevis, tertius, and plantar fascia around the fifth metatarsal base, 3, myodesis of the anterior tibialis to the medial and middle cuneiforms, 4, lengthening of the gastroc soleus, that is the Achilles tendon, and 5, osteotomy through the first metatarsal. So a Lisfranc amputation is through the tarsal metatarsal joints, except the second metatarsal, which is osteotomized to preserve the stability of the medial cuneiform. To prevent the patient from supinating the foot following this amputation, the everters on the foot must be maintained. The principal everters are the peroneus brevis and longus. Therefore, the function of the peroneus brevis must be preserved. Technically, this is done preserving the soft tissue envelope, that is the peroneus brevis, tertius, and plantar fascia, around the fifth metatarsal base. So the correct answer to this question is 2, preserving the soft tissue envelope, that is the peroneus brevis, tertius, and plantar fascia around the fifth metatarsal base. Moving on to the next question. A 66-year-old male sustains an open crush injury to his right lower leg with significant skin loss. His history is significant for COPD, diabetes controlled with an insulin pump, and testicular cancer treated with bleomycin 20 years ago. A radiograph of the chest shows a small pneumothorax which is being observed and does not require a thoracostomy tube. Which of the following is not a contraindication to hyperbaric oxygen treatment for this patient? And the choices are 1, presence of an acute open fracture and crush injury, 2, history of COPD, 3, history of bleomycin treatment, 4, presence of a pneumothorax, and 5, presence of an insulin pump. So the presence of a crush injury to an extremity is an indication for hyperbaric oxygen therapy. The remainder of the options listed are contraindications to hyperbaric oxygen treatment. So the correct answer to this question is 1, presence of an acute open fracture and crush injury. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy potentially can provide enhanced oxygen delivery to peripheral tissues affected by vascular disruption, cytogenic and vasogenic edema, and cellular hypoxia caused by extremity trauma. The idea behind hyperbaric oxygen is to provide enhanced oxygen delivery to peripheral tissues affected by vascular disruption, cytogenic and vasogenic edema, as well as cellular hypoxia caused by extremity trauma. Greensmith et al. Provide a review of hyperbaric oxygen therapy and discuss the relative and absolute contraindications and indications for this treatment. They report in patients with crush injury or early compartment syndrome, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may reduce the penumbra of cells at risk for delayed necrosis and secondary ischemia. They report that both animal studies and prospective human clinical trials suggest the benefits of such therapy. Moving on to the next question. A 7-year-old male is struck by a motor vehicle while crossing the street and suffers an open tibia fracture with a crush injury of the ipsilateral foot. After multiple attempts at limb salvage, the family and treating surgeon elect to proceed with a knee disarticulation. What complication of pediatric amputations is avoided with a knee disarticulation as opposed to a transtibial amputation? And the choices are 1. Neurogenic pain, 2. Bone overgrowth, 3. Hip flexion contracture, 4. Hip adduction contracture, and 5. Leg length inequality. So bone overgrowth is a poorly understood phenomenon in which the bone end undergoes disorganized appositional growth following amputation in a skeletally immature patient. Overgrowth is the most common complication following transosseous amputation in pediatric patients. So the correct answer to this question is 2, bone overgrowth. And moving on to the final question for this topic, which of the following is most important to achieve a good outcome following a SIAM amputation? And the choices are 1, trimming any dog ears, 2, a viable and stable heel pad, 3, Achilles tendon lengthening, 4, preserving the malleoli, and 5, tenodesing the extensor digitorum longus to the tibial shaft. So a SIAM amputation is effectively a tibio-tailored disarticulation which provides an end-bearing stump that could potentially allow ambulation without a prosthesis over short distances. It works better for tumor and trauma, but the heel pad must be viable. The two most common problems are 1, skin sloughing from compromised vascular supply, and 2, migration of the heel pad due to instability. A hypermobile heel pad can cause difficulty with prosthesis wear and damage to the soft tissues, which can eventually lead to failure. Both malleoli are usually removed in the procedure, except in children or during the first stage procedure of a diabetic or infection case. The tibialis anterior is usually tenodesed to the anterior heel pad along with the extensor digitorum longus tendon to avoid posterior migration of the heel pad. That's all for this question session about liposarcoma and amputations. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.